My name is Andrew Smith, and I am the Executive Director of George Washington University's chapter of Young America's Foundation. GWYAF is the conservative movement on campus, and we are excited to welcome you to a stop on the Men Are Not Women and Other Uncomfortable Truths lecture tour with Michael Knowles of the Daily Wire, brought to you by the generous support of the Logan family. After the lecture, there will be a question and answer session. If you're interested, please line up behind the pink line on the right side of the amphitheater. We are so glad that you're here and expect everyone in attendance to conduct themselves with the highest level of professionalism. If there are any disruptions, university police will escort you out of the venue. I would now like to introduce my good friend and the president of GWYAF, Matthew Masterbirdie.
Hi there, my name is Matthew Masterbirdie, and I am the president of GWYAF. It is my distinct honor today to introduce our speaker, Mr. Michael Knowles. He will be giving his speech entitled, George Washington is Canceled, as hosted by the Logan family. Great. Michael Knowles hosts the incredibly popular The Michael Knowles Show at the Daily Wire. In 2017, he wrote the number one national best-selling book, Reasons to Vote for Democrats, A Comprehensive Guide, which President Donald Trump hailed as a great book for your reading enjoyment. Later this year, Michael has a podcast coming with PragerU entitled The Book Club, so stay tuned for that. Before his blank book fame, Michael studied history and Italian literature at Yale University, graduating with honors. At Yale, Michael rendered the first ever translation for the English stage of political philosopher Machiavelli's play, The Girl from Andros, which scholars hailed as a watershed event for the English-speaking world. Starting in 2017, he teamed up with acclaimed novelist and screenwriter, Andrew Klavan, to perform the 13-episode narrative podcast, Another Kingdom, which garnered nearly 2,000 five-star reviews by the release of its final installment, rising to become one of the most popular arts podcasts of the year before being renewed for a second season. Michael appears regularly on news and commentary programs nationwide. He's lectured at research universities and universities throughout the United States, including UPenn, Michigan State, the University of Wisconsin, the University of Michigan, and today, the George Washington University. So please join me in welcoming Mr. Michael Knowles to the stage.
All right, thank you so much. Thank you for coming out. Lovely to see everybody. Thank you, as always, to YAF for hosting. Thank you to GW for inviting me. Thank you to the Logan family for sponsoring this entire tour. This is the third stop on our tour. The tour is titled Men Are Not Women and Other Uncomfortable Truths. This is based on a speech that I gave in the spring at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. That speech was titled Men Are Not Women. I thought it would be the least controversial speech I ever gave. It was not. I was protested. I was physically assaulted by some weirdo with a super soaker who sprayed me with creepy chemicals and ruined my suit. So I thought that that would be the least controversial statement that I could make in one of these tours. And then you guys called me. You guys here at GW, stands for George Washington University. And I was asked to give a speech in defense of George Washington at George Washington University. George Washington, one of the greatest men who ever lived, and specifically in this case, George the Colonial, who is the mascot of GW, as well as all of those colonials who gave this world and gave all of us this great nation. How did poor old George the Colonial become so controversial? It all began last year when a handful of students with apparently too much time on their hands circulated a petition demanding that the colonial mascot be removed and replaced. They wrote, this is from the petition, "The use of colonials, no matter how innocent the intention, is received as extremely offensive, not only by students of the university, but by the nation and the world at large. The petition went on. The historically negatively charged figure of colonials has too deep a connection to colonization. And they said this of George the Colonial, big mascot, glorifies the act of systemic oppression. Now, the moment that I read this position, or petition rather, I knew one thing. I knew one thing for certain. This had to be written by white liberals. I knew it. I knew, because the way, you know, the language, it would make it seem like it was written by somebody who is a recent immigrant or the child of some oppressed group, but I knew it wasn't. The only thing I knew for sure from that language is that it was white liberals. And then I Googled it, and it would appear that I'm correct. I don't want to make assumptions. I don't know the students, but it would appear to be the case that I'm right. How did I know that? Because this sort of activism is always the product of white liberals pretending to be offended on behalf of other people. It's never Native Americans who are clamoring to change the name of the Washington Redskins or the Cleveland Indians. It is always white liberals pretending to be offended on their behalf. It must be nice. Do these white liberals have jobs? Do they have anything to do? Do they have any problems of their own, I wonder? This is the best evidence that I have ever found for white privilege, is the fact that white liberals pull these stunts all the time. If you have so much time and emotional energy that you are spending all of it pretending to be offended on other people's behalf, you have privilege. The petition got 514 signatures. So this means it's a big school, but you know, they got 514, so it was taken up for a vote. And the student body voted on whether or not to remove Colonial as the mascot. The measure passed this past March. That is the bad news. The good news is it passed by a pretty slim margin. Just 54% of the students who voted to get rid of poor old George the Colonial. The detailed numbers are more revealing because only 5,000 students actually participated in the vote. Now, the school has about 12,000 undergrads and about 25,000 or 26,000 students total. So if you look at the percentage overall, as a percentage of the undergraduate population, only 42% of people voted and only 23% voted to remove the mascot. If you look at this as a percentage of the total university population, then just 20% voted and only 11% voted to remove the Colonial. Those numbers are about what I would expect. Because if you want to pretend that George the Colonial is offensive, you will be highly motivated to vote on this issue. If you are a normal person, you will not be motivated to waste your time on this ridiculous controversy. And this is how the left wins the culture. The issue seems trivial on its face. The issue says, who cares who the mascot of GW is, right? Most of us, and even GW students apparently, couldn't possibly care less. So a small percentage of radical leftists impose their will on the broader blasé student population, and then the moniker goes away. And it's in the process of going away already. The university has already renamed the Student Center, which used to be called this very nice, charming, personal Colonial Center. Now it is just the bureaucratic Student Services Hub. The Colonial Army, which the Colonial Army is a club that I guess brings students to the sporting events. They've rebranded themselves George's Army. This is pretty interesting. I mean, the question is, what's the over-under on how long George's army lasts before George himself, George Washington, is considered too hopelessly bigoted to be the mascot or even branded on the university. Now, GW bears some blame here, even for the relatively small number of students who are demanding the name change. Because, after all, GW is responsible for the students' education. So if they have been duped into thinking that references to American colonials are somehow offensive, then GW bears some of that blame. If they believe that George Washington is some sort of wicked historical figure, GW bears some blame for either indoctrinating the students into that position or for not correcting them for this misconception that they have. But it's not just GW's fault. This kind of educational malpractice is going on at universities across the country, and it's been going on for a very long time. The Intercollegiate Studies Institute, ISI, did a survey. This was now 10 years ago, of civics and history and knowledge of the country. They went to some of the most elite universities in the country, Stanford, Harvard, Yale, all these schools. They found out that students lacked knowledge of even the most basic aspects of American history. And worse yet, what they found in this study is that graduating seniors knew less about American politics, civics, and history than incoming freshmen. They were becoming more ignorant each and every semester. I think ignorance plays a major role here in the effort to get rid of GW's colonial mascot and moniker, George himself. The activists make a number of mistakes, not merely in their logic, but even in their grasp of basic facts, the first of which is to whom the word colonials refers. The leftist students are upset because the word colonials has, quote, too deep a connection to colonization and glorifies the act of systemic oppression. So here we see that the students are confusing three distinct and separate concepts: colonialism, the American colonials themselves, and George Washington, the Big Daddy. We could spend an entire evening discussing the topic of colonialism. Very quickly, that system of government certainly claimed many victims since it was adopted first in the 15th century. European colonialism involved nine, at least, major European powers. Colonialism, though, was not limited just to European powers. Colonialism was practiced elsewhere. Imperial Japan conquered and controlled and governed some 6,000 islands at its peak. Actually, the only reason that Imperial Japan gave up colonialism is because the United States made them give up colonialism at the end of the Second World War in their surrender. It wasn't just Japan, though. You saw this in the Ottoman Empire, too. Muslim colonialism lasted nearly as long as its European counterpart, and the Ottomans ruled over various colonies from the mid-15th century all the way up through a few years past World War I. Obviously, plenty of people were the victims of this system of government. But of course, colonialism did accomplish certain things, namely, none of us would be here today, and the United States would not exist without colonialism, because we were colonies. That must count for something. With the exception of those of us in this room whose heritage is purely Native American Indian, 1/1,000th does not count. That is not sufficient. You got to be 1,000/1,000ths. With that exception, none of us would be anywhere in the Americas today without colonialism. The Latino race would not exist without colonialism. It's easy to cast aspersions on our forebears from our privileged positions in the most powerful, most equitable, most just, most prosperous country in the history of the world. It's far more difficult and humbling to recognize the complexities of history and show gratitude for the people who made our lives possible. All of that is beside the point. All of that has been missed by the ignorant activists who insist that GW ditch the colonial. The point that they're missing is this: the colonials that the mascot represents were not defenders of colonialism. In fact, they were the opposite of defenders of colonialism. They fought a bloody war, they risked their lives to end colonialism in America and to end rule in Great Britain. They wanted their political independence.
Fuck you, you fucking fascist!
Shame! 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 Shame!
Oh, there. These kids are really proving me wrong. You see, because my premise was that these students are ignorant and not well behaved. But they're proving me wrong tonight. They called me a fascist for defending George Washington. Behold your country, leftists. Behold. I hope the cameras catch all the faces here, too. Because I think this school costs about $70,000 a year to attend. This is the job they've done. Hey, just for the people in the room, if you have, like that guy right there. What did I say? What did I say that you disagree with? Does anyone have anything? What did I say that any of you disagree with? Can you name one thing?
Yes.
What? Well, what is it? What is it? What did I say? I can't hear over all the shouting and the screeching and the. What did I say that you disagree with?
Could you?
Thunder? I can't. What are you saying? I can't hear it. So they can't name one thing. They can't name one thing. You guys are doing a great job here at GW, professors. Oh, my goodness. So I don't know. I think that pretty much proves my point. I guess that's the end of the speech, right? That's what happens. Thank you so much. But how do you feel about George Washington? You love him even more. All right, good. Well, I'm glad that now that those people left the room, now we can bring in more people to hear about George Washington. Welcome back in. Glad to hear it. As I was saying, some kids have missed the point. They missed the point entirely. Because if they were in the room, or if they could listen, or if they had two brain cells to rub together, what they would have realized is, if you oppose colonialism, then you should love the colonial mascot. The colonial mascot is a symbol of fighting colonialism in America. The colonial should be their hero. I don't know who their hero is. I don't want to know who their hero is. Do we want to rename your mascot like the fightin' AOC or something? Then you'll have to transfer. It'll be a whole thing. So at this point, when you bring this up, as we just saw, the anti-colonial activists get even more confused than they already are. Because while they insist that GW remove and replace George the Colonial as their mascot, they don't insist that GW remove references to George Washington, who is a colonial, who is George the Colonial. George the Colonial is George Washington. He is a colonial. His name is George. He's the mascot of George Washington University. He's George Washington. He's not George Jefferson. He's not George Clinton. He's not George Lucas. He is George Washington. So why don't they want to get rid of Washington? In some ways, it's nice to see that GW leftists haven't completely turned on Washington himself. President Trump predicted 2 years ago that they would do that. You remember, I love this. 2 years ago, he predicted that as people are toppling statues now left and right, pretty soon they would turn on George Washington. And everyone made fun of him at the time, and then it happened. It actually happened recently in California. San Francisco School Board just voted this year to remove a mural, to remove, cover it up with a tarp, get it out of there, to remove a mural of George Washington at George Washington High School. The reason for this is that the mural was triggering to the students. This is true. Unless we stem the tide of ignorance and unless we reacquaint ourselves with our own national history, we are going to see many, many more attacks in the coming years on the father of our country. Now, it's ironic that those people that just left the room, these GW leftist activists, have chosen to attack George the Colonial while sparing George Washington. I think the reason they do it is because they don't want to mess up their resumes, because even they, and they don't have a whole lot going on, but even they realize, wait a second, if I convince everyone in the country that George Washington is Hitler, and then I go in for a job interview and my only resume line is I went to George Washington University, that's not going to look great. So we'll spare Washington, but we'll go after the colonial. Now, it's ironic that they would demand the erasure of the average colonial while still preserving Washington. Because despite Washington's countless virtues, he was not a perfect man. Specifically, he committed the sin, God bless, he committed the sin most likely to get one statue topped these days, which is that George Washington owned slaves. And he didn't own just a few slaves. George Washington owned a lot of slaves. Washington inherited his first 10 slaves at the age of 11. He inherited them when his father died. He was irate. He became bewildered when his slaves would run away from him. He just didn't understand it. Even a man as great as George Washington. The average colonial didn't own a single slave. According to the Gilder Lehrman Institute of American History, by 1860, so we're talking about the height of American slavery, the peak intensity of American slavery, 3/4 of white families in the US didn't own a single slave. 1% of families owned 40 or more slaves. Just 0.1% of Americans owned 100 or more slaves. That was 85 years after the Revolution, at the very height of American slavery. George Washington owned 124 slaves, and he leased or otherwise controlled an additional 193 slaves. The average American colonial was slaveless and poor. George Washington had hundreds of slaves and was the richest president in American history until 2016. He is now the second richest president in American history because George Washington didn't own any golf courses or casinos, so he was not able to beat out the current occupant of the White House. In any case, despite his human flaws, George Washington is one of the greatest men who ever lived. He is the indispensable founding father, the greatest president. Without his leadership, the country would never have been born. If it had been born, it would not have survived infancy. Providence smiled on George Washington in ways that awe believers and dumbfound atheists. George Washington almost didn't make it to the Revolution because on July 9th, 1755, while George Washington was riding forward at the Battle of Monongahela during the French and Indian War, Washington had two horses shot out from under him. When he ended the battle, he had four bullet holes in his coat, and he walked away unscathed. At the Battle of Princeton during the Revolutionary War, Washington at one point rode his white charger in a counterattack against the British that put him 30 yards from the British line. He's a massive target on a massive white horse. If they had gotten him, it probably could have ended the war, and he left unscathed. In August of 1776, the British had Washington and the Patriots surrounded in Brooklyn. This is one of the many reasons that I avoid going to Brooklyn. It is mostly the hipsters, but it is also some memories of the Redcoats surrounding George Washington. They've got the Patriots surrounded. British General Howe gives the order to dig trenches all around the Americans. The only hope for the Americans is for Washington to somehow secretly smuggle out 9,000 American troops across the East River out of Brooklyn in the middle of the night without detection. This is a virtually impossible task. By sunrise, a huge portion of the Patriots are stranded in Brooklyn. The war is on the brink of being lost. He keeps ferrying the men across. Washington keeps it up. He doesn't stop. Then, providentially, as the sun rises and threatens to give up the Patriots' plan and doom the whole war, a heavy fog rolls over Brooklyn, gives Washington just enough time to get the Patriots out. When the fog is lifted, the Americans are gone. Historian David McCulloch explained this moment. He said, incredibly, yet again, and this happened again and again in the Revolutionary War, fate, luck, providence, the hand of God, as would be said so often, intervened. Washington's greatness extended far beyond the battlefield. He was alone in being able to unite disparate factions of the founding fathers. With his peerless dignity and with the humility of Cincinnatus, Washington resigned his military commission as commander-in-chief in 1783. In 1788 and 1789, he was elected president unanimously. Needless to say, he is the only president in American history to be elected unanimously. Even the dead bodies in Ohio that the left digs up every 4 years, even they would have voted for George Washington, because they may have been alive at the time, actually. And then the left only digs him up 150 years later. In any case, he accepted the election. He serves as president. After 2 terms, he voluntarily steps down. Even Washington's enemies attested to his greatness. When George Washington resigned his military commission, no less an opponent of his than King George III called Washington the greatest man in the world. Specifically, he said, that act closing and finishing what had gone before and viewed in connection with it placed him in a light, the most distinguished of any man living. And he said that he was the greatest character of the age. He was the greatest character of the age. He's one of the greatest men who ever lived. And now, lazy campus leftists who shriek and they shout and they get up and they scream and they can't answer even the basic question of what are you so upset about, now those people want to cancel George Washington. They want to cancel his mascot iteration, George the Colonial. They want to cancel all of our founding fathers, the colonials broadly, those great men who gave us this wonderful country. And do you know who they want to replace him with? A hippopotamus. That is true. I read that in print. I read it on the petition. The petition to replace George the Colonial suggests, quote, alternative nickname recommendations are hippos or river horses. They want to replace our colonial forebears, the first soldiers and veterans who fought for us and won for us our country, George Washington himself, with a hippopotamus. This would be absolutely hilarious if it were not so, so sad. Because the question is, what have these entitled and ignorant history erasers ever done themselves? Those people who were shrieking and screaming, what have they ever done? What credibility do they have? What authority do they have? Outrageous. They signal their own virtue every chance they get. What virtue have they ever actually enacted or embodied? those spoiled, overgrown children stand atop the shoulders of giants, and they think that they're flying. They never, ever seem to pause and reflect on their own imperfections. They never seem to know even what they're shouting about. They attack the colonials for occupying a land previously inhabited by Native Americans. We all occupy that same land today. Why don't any of us leave? Why don't any of them leave? They're the ones making the claim. If this is stolen land, then why don't those people pick up and go back to their ancestral lands? For most people, that would be an impossibility, because in America, we all hail from ancestrally from many different places. Would I go back to Italy? Would I go back to Ireland? Would I go back to Britain? I don't know. I'd try to figure out a way to go back to Greenland, because I know that that's going to come back into America pretty soon. I don't know. It would be impossible for the vast majority of us, virtually any of us, to go back to our ancestral lands. Because in America, uniquely in the world, we all have a big mix of a lot of different ancestral things going on. Isn't that nice? Isn't that a wonderful thing? Isn't that something maybe that we should thank our forebears for? Some of those forebears owned slaves, many of them uneasily, many of them confusedly. We view that peculiar institution today with moral clarity. Okay. How will future generations look on us? To use the most obvious example, we murder 1 million babies a year in this country, 1 million a year, through abortion. Will history forgive us for abetting that kind of widespread evil? How will we look compared to those great men? Are we really wise to cast aspersions with the perspective of 250 years on men and women who are in so many ways better than us? The anti-historical, anti-intellectual, and anti-American fanaticism that would do away with George the Colonial is caused by ignorance, of course. But more than that, it is caused by pride. Our generation's unearned and unwarranted sense of moral superiority over our ancestors. That's pride. George Washington had a motto, and GW has adopted this motto very often. We would all do well to remember it. The motto is three words. It says, deeds, not words. Deeds, not words. Washington was famously reticent. He didn't signal his virtue to his countrymen. George Washington didn't need to signal his virtue. He enacted virtue. Our founding fathers' critics would do very well to emulate not just Washington, but so many of our colonial forebears. If they quieted their uninformed yaps and instead performed even some small fraction of the great deeds of those great men, those great American colonials, they and all the rest of us would be better off. Perhaps then, we might be interested in what those people have to say. Now, certainly, we are not. Until then, I'm sticking with George the Colonial, first in war, first in peace, and first in the hearts of his countrymen. Thank you very much. So we have time for questions. We have a rule at the Daily Wire, which is when we do these speeches on the AFT tours, if you disagree with us, you get to cut to the front of the line. But I think everybody who disagreed with me in this room is now crying somewhere across the campus about how mean I was saying they're not quite sure what. So please feel free to line up and we'll get into some questions.
Yeah, so the line's gonna be over here. Make sure if you have a question to actually ask a question, not just, you know, give a little lecture. So yeah, be careful.
Hi, thank you again for coming. So obviously we're very divided as a nation. So my question is there hope to reunite the country and how best to go about that?
Yes, I'm not upset that we're divided in terms of I want this politician or I want that politician or I like this policy or I like that policy. I think that's perfectly fine. I like that we have a choice, not an echo, to use Phyllis Schlafly's words. In many ways, the conservative movement was about that. What worries me more about our division is we seem not to hold anything in common anymore. We don't have much of a common religion, certainly. We have the right generally favoring traditional religion. We have the left making sacrifices to the sun gods right now, so in the form of climate protests. So we don't have a common religion. We don't have much of a common culture. We don't have common TV shows. We don't go see the same movies. We don't read the same books. Half the country certainly doesn't read any books. And so that's a problem. And then, of course, on the political level, we have our political divisions as well. One thing that really saddens and worries me is, I can speak for myself, but there is a lot of social scientific evidence. Conservatives don't really hate the left. They don't really hate liberals themselves. We hate leftism. We hate what the left is doing to this country. But we don't unfriend people on social media very much. We don't throw people out and say, you can't come to dinner anymore because you disagree with me on some political issue. The left does that. We've seen it in study after study. The left, John Haidt did that study where he showed that the left doesn't really understand where the conservatives are coming from, whereas conservatives understand what the left is saying. And usually it amounts to, wah, wah, as you just saw earlier this evening. That worries me a lot. If you've got half the country who thinks genuinely that we are irredeemable and deplorable, you can't really have a country together after that. There's not much we can do. I mean, we can make jokes, we can say our point of view, we can refuse to back down, and we can welcome people to have conversations and to come have dinner. But when you're in a battle, your opponent gets a say. And if they're not going to deal with us, they're half the country too, and we'll just be waiting when they either come to their senses or completely lose their minds. Yeah.
Well, I hope those kids feel gratified.
I certainly do.
Yeah, so I was wondering what your take is on the whole impeachment situation, and then also specifically, I know like Speaker Pelosi said that she prays for the president and is really sad about this and finds no joy in it, so specifically about that too.
I don't know who Nancy Pelosi prays to, but I don't want their help, whoever it is. I think impeachment is excellent for the president. I think it's excellent for Nancy Pelosi. I think it's bad for Democrats' presidential prospects. It helps Pelosi because she gets to keep control of her caucus, which increasingly was going over to AOC plus three. So it's helpful to her to, look, I don't think she even cares about retaking the White House. I think Nancy Pelosi wants to be the Speaker of the House when she has no responsibilities and no accountability, and she's done a pretty good job of it. So it's gonna help her. It'll help President Trump fundraise. He raised $8.5 million over the course of 2 days on this, and he's raised $125 million in the third quarter. To put that number in perspective, Barack Obama in 2011 raised $70 million in the third quarter, and that was pretty good too. Trump almost doubled it, so impeachment is very helpful to him. They're not going to get him on anything because there's no evidence that a crime was committed. If a crime was committed, the crime was first committed by Joe Biden, who is the Democrats' current frontrunner, so it looks like it's going to kill his prospects. The campaign seems to be falling apart already, and then you have either Bernie Sanders or Liz Warren battling it out, and if that campaign continues, Bernie is going to pull Liz Warren even further to the left, which we just saw a new poll came out. When independent voters see the leftward lurch of the Democratic Party, they're 6% less likely to vote for them for president. So I think, I wouldn't be surprised if President Trump was the whistleblower and then he blamed it on some poor guy in the CIA. I think it's working out very well for him, very well for Pelosi. Politics makes strange bedfellows, but it's pretty bad news for the left. Yeah.
Well, I had planned on spraying you with non-toxic household chemicals.
I'm here.
I left my lavender oil at home.
Oh, that's too bad. All right. That's a new suit. It was ready for it.
No, I'm very sorry. So you speak a lot about conservatives and the battle that they have on campus for student opinion. How can we succeed at not only, you know, presenting the case for conservatism, but how can we, you know, win that battle over student opinion, generally speaking? And also, could I get a selfie with you?
Those are separate questions.
They are separate. There's a
yes. Well, the answer to the latter is yes. Though I guess this would tie into my next answer, because if you get a selfie with me, you're going to have a tough time among a left-wing culture on campus. The first thing you need is courage. Courage is the prerequisite of all of the virtues, and we don't have a lot of it these days, even, I'm sorry to say, among conservatives, even among people who are not far-left leftists, because you could lose your job, you could lose your reputation, you could lose your grades, you could lose a lot of things for stating basic and obvious truths. So you need courage, and you need to be willing to take the hits. You've also got to speak. You don't need to just throw bombs. I mean, it's funny sometimes to do that, but you don't need to do that. You need to just speak the truth above all things. You need to speak the truth when you use your pronouns. They're so insistent on getting you to use the wrong pronouns and call a man a woman and a woman a man because they want to dominate your thought. They want you to kneel down and say, I don't even have the right to believe my own eyes. I'll believe you before that happens. You've got to be willing to do that and take the punches. That is about courage. And with courage, you'll get the other virtues. but they practice the vices. So for instance, they hold whole parades for pride. I don't know what PR strategist made them think, hey, you know the deadliest of the seven deadly sins? Let's celebrate that for an entire month. Probably not a great idea. But what's the opposite of pride is humility. You've got to have some humility. True humility does away with false modesty, and the truth can seem like an arrogant thing. That's what you've got to stand for. You've got to have the courage to do it, and it is going to cost you. There's no such thing as a free lunch. But if you're not willing to pay those costs, if you're not willing to actually fight for something, what are you doing here anyway? Yeah, good question. Come on up. All right, next question. Like slipping me his number over here? We're going on a date after this? All right. Gosh. I bring up one mention of pride parades and a guy gives me his number.
Thank you, Mr. Knowles, for coming out. We appreciate it. How would you characterize the role of like the religious segregation and artificial birth control on really this whole societal degeneracy and this really of our country, you know, falling apart?
Conservatives need to talk not just about policies and economic issues, but about culture. And not just about culture, but about religion. Because there was a famous cardinal who said that at bottom, all political disagreements are theological disagreements. St. Andrew Breitbart, the patron of Hollywood conservatives, said politics is downstream of culture, and cult and culture are related words. What the culture worships defines that culture. Nobody wakes up in the middle of the night and says, we've got to lower the top marginal tax rate by 0.2%. Oh, we have to. Then we'll have a country. But no one cares about that. I like low taxes as much as the next guy. But that is not motivating to people. Because ultimately, we are religious beings. We long for religion. And everybody's got to serve somebody. So when the left abandons traditional religion, they don't just become materialists. They become weird cultist materialists. I mean, just last week you had children taking off school for multiple days at a time to protest the weather or something. And it was being organized by the government, so I don't even know what they were protesting. They were all on the same side. Bernie Sanders came out and said that we need to sacrifice our children to the climate gods. We need to stop global warming by not having children anymore. You hear this, NBC News came out and created a climate confessional. Very Catholic, I kind of like that. But it's like the opposite of Catholic because they're worshiping the creation rather than the creator. The rot begins at that level, at the religious level. You will not have an irreligious America that's successful. But John Adams put it very well. He said, the country is built for a moral and religious people. It is not fit to the governance of anybody else, moral and religious, because morality, it doesn't just float in the air. It has a shape, it has form. It looks like something. And if you are not going to enact that, if you are not going to deal in metaphysical reality, then you are going to find yourself very, very confused, not without religion, but with a very, very strange-looking religion where you are clamoring and screaming at the sky for it to stop being so sunny every day. Yeah.
Hi, Michael. Thanks for coming out. That very civil and articulate young gentleman up there was actually yelling at you about Greta Thunberg.
Oh.
And your comments on her, I guess, is what he was referring to.
Was she colonial? I don't think so.
But it made me think, why is it that you, something about you, you cause the most outrage when you state the most simple facts?
You know, I wonder why that is. I've always tried to fix that, you know? I just want to be a nice guy and get along and have everybody like me. It's actually a very good question, which is, what sort of temperament provokes the most discussion? What sort of temperament can cut through the crowd? I think I'm the least angry guy in politics. I notice everybody in politics is screaming and shouting. That's certainly true on the left, all those people we just saw. It's even true in some quarters on the right. And I'm not angry. I have a great life. I didn't do anything to be born into this world. I've got this wonderful life. I'm not gonna have any say in when I leave this world, and then I hope and trust that I'll go to an eternal reward. That's pretty good. What's there to be upset about? Taxes? I don't think so. So I think what is very effective in politics, I've always found it personally to be very effective, is state the truth calmly, confidently. It's funny, during that news hit, there was that other gentleman on stage who was very, very angry. And he called me skinny boy, which is apparently an insult. I didn't know it was an insult. I took it as a compliment. And he was yelling, and veins were coming out of his neck. And what he said was, relax. Now, I never raised my voice. I never got upset. They do that. That's what the left does. When you aren't confident in the point that you're making, when you're not sure of what you think, when you haven't thought something through, you shout. There's a classic story of the pastor who is putting his sermon together, and he underlines one sentence, and he goes, weak point, shout. That way you'll be able to convince people. A lot of people are talking loud and saying nothing. You never hear a smart guy tell a stupid guy how smart he is. That doesn't happen a lot. You do hear a lot of stupid people tell smart guys how smart they are, because they're not secure in that. They're trying to prove something that isn't true. I think the way to behave in politics is, I think most people are totally normal, and they're not screaming crazy wackos. And you should talk to those people, and they get it. The people get it, okay? And if you talk to those people confidently, you're gonna be a lot more persuasive than if you scream and shout. The screams and the shouts might get more YouTube clicks in the short term, but you're gonna be a lot less persuasive over the long run. Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Knowles, for coming to George Washington and the People's Republic of Washington, D.C. The only beacon of hope we have is President Trump. Can I get your autograph later?
Sure.
In a picture?
Yeah.
So my main inquiry for you is, conservatives, we like to talk about a lot about the education system, how corrupt it is, filled with liberals and stuff like that. But what can we do, like, in legislative means and, like, trying to run for school board offices to try to change, quote-unquote, the culture of education?
This is hugely important. This should be conservatives' maybe number one issue when you're actually talking about policy, because I think what you hear a lot, especially from the more liberal side of the conservative movement, is, well, there's nothing you can do. We just need to increase individual freedom. We just need to get out of it, get hands off, and that'll be a lot better. That doesn't work with education. Education is, by definition, coercive. And in this country, the government controls most of education. So you're not going to be able to get out of it that easily. You're not going to be able to lower taxes and then it's going to fix education. That's not how it works. And education means more than just learning the dates of battles and which men were fighting in different battles. Education is also how you're brought up. It's how you behave. You know, in Italian, the word for misbehaved is maleducato. The education is, it's the whole person, not just the books that you put into your head. Obviously, we're not doing a great job of education in this country if a group of college students at a very well-known, prestigious private university can get up and scream and shout during a pretty basic historical lecture on George Washington, the namesake of the college. Obviously, we haven't done a very good job. And so, conservatives need to push on this. Education is coercive. We need to open up venues for conservatives to break the stranglehold of teacher unions and cultural leftism. We're seeing that now with charter schools. We're seeing that now with school choice generally. We're seeing that with a major homeschooling movement and the religious schools. We need to encourage that tremendously. That's the best hope we have. Campuses are a crystal ball. When you look at a campus, you are looking at your country in 20 years. And you guys are great, but the ones who ran out of here screaming and crying give me some serious fears for the country. So conservatives need to stop thinking just so practically about the practical level. I'm going to lower my taxes, or I'm going to pursue this minor policy. Think about education. Think 20 years down the line. The leftist march through the institutions gave us a lot of trouble in the past decades. We can take it back, but we have to have the kind of patience and determination that they had before us. Yeah. Yes. All right. Wow, this is cool. It's so weird. It's a blank check made out to Cash.
Official.
Is your name Cash?
Nope, it's Joseph. That's the president I had with him.
Joseph. Thanks. That's
can I
very
take
cool.
The picture with you?
Yeah, sure.
Can you take the picture with me? I don't like selfies.
All right. Thank you.
All right.
Could you write an official book plate too? Because when I buy your book, I can just tape it in there for jokes. Official book plate.
You want me to write a poem in here too? Hold on.
Oh, no. Look. Only Machiavelli's the prince.
Only the, yeah, okay, that's good. Maybe
right.
I'll write a haiku.
Say, big league.
All right.
Nancy Pelosi's flying circus.
All right, next question.
Thank you so much for coming, and thank you so much for standing up to these fascist leftist worshippers of government. Thank you so much, really.
Thank you.
So my question is, to what degree is Catholicism more or less compatible with smaller republicanism, federalism, and capitalism?
Oh, it's completely compatible. There's a good book on this subject that just came out from Tim Gordon called Catholic Republic, I think it's called, gives an overview of this. Because what are we really asking? I mean, I don't think anybody's going to institute a papal monarchy to control the government of the United States. Depends on the Pope, but I think these days we're pretty much not exactly pushing for that. And so when you look at our republic, so much of that is grounded in natural law, and natural law is one of the many great contributions of the Catholic Church to the intellectual life of the West. When you talk about capitalism, I mean, the protection of property rights begins in the church, specifically in the School of Salamanca. When you read, I know it can be confusing some days when there are more left-wing people in the church, but some of the greatest denunciations of socialism came from popes. I mean, Pope Leo XIII referred to socialism as a pest and a plague and a wicked confederacy of people who want to steal the very gospel itself and that must be utterly rejected. That is strong language. And this goes on to Pope John Paul II in Centesimus Annus. He wrote that free markets are the most efficient way to allocate goods and services in an economy. I mean, there's a strong defense of so much of what we believe in the United States. And certainly, as our founding father John Adams knew, the country is built for a moral and religious people. That religion does look like something. It is geared towards something. And not all ideas are the same. I don't think he meant the religion of climate change. I think he was talking about our traditional religion in this country. And we've lost that, and we've lost the sense of that at our own national peril. And if we want to gain back some national greatness, we're going to have to take not just political seriousness, and not even just cultural seriousness, but we have to take our religion seriously, too. Great question. We'll do pictures afterward. But yeah, we'll do. Come find me afterward, and we'll definitely do a picture. All right. Thanks. The only reason that I had to say no to that picture is I wanted this gentleman in this T-shirt to be able, that is an incredible T-shirt. My first question to you is, where did you get that T-shirt?
Lake Placid, New York, this summer, actually.
It's a bit of a hike. Yeah. I'll have to have to make it up.
It's worth it. It's worth it. But well, thank you so much for coming out to George Washington. And I really thank you for upsetting the protesters, because then I was able to move up. So thank you very much for that. But my question is, so in my opinion, the 2020 election is pretty secured for Donald Trump with, like, the Mueller report, the whole Ukraine thing, Green New Deal. But with the, like, increase of tech companies censoring conservatives and then the left-leaning echo chambers on campus, would you say that there in 2024 that we are going to have, like, another Republican win?
I'm not going to even predict the 2020 election. You know, the left was pretty confident that Hillary was going to win in 2016, and it didn't work out so well for them. So I don't want to go in too cocky. I tend to agree with you. I think things look very good for President Trump right now, and nobody can predict now 5 years into the future for 2024. But I think you're right. I think a lot of the explanation of why the left is behaving like they are right now is because they don't feel confident to win against Trump. I think they're allowing this Joe Biden-Ukraine controversy to open up by pursuing impeachment because they know Biden isn't a great front runner. They know he does the best of any of them against Trump, but he's probably not going to take it, so they're willing to just get rid of his candidacy. And I think the same is true of Bernie and Warren. I mean, they're just running so far left that I don't think the prospects are very good. The incumbent has a great advantage, generally speaking. Obama got reelected, Bush got reelected, Clinton got reelected, Reagan got reelected. I mean, there's a great advantage to incumbency. And there's also a great advantage to doing a good job. And the president has done a good job. You had 8 years of economic misery under Barack Obama. You had, they told me if I voted for John McCain, that we would start more wars in the Middle East. And they were right. I voted for John McCain, and we started more wars in the Middle East. You had an expansion of all these wars. And so Trump has come in, and regardless of whether you think he's the greatest president ever, or you agree with everything he's done, he's just objectively done such a much better job than his predecessor that I suspect he'll be rewarded by the voters. And I also suspect if they nominate some wacko leftist like Laya Wathe, I don't think she's going to play very well in Peoria. Oh. Yeah. Thanks.
Sir, thank you for coming tonight. My main question for you is, I know that Ben Shapiro and you believe in a lot about facts over feelings, but how can we find that in today's news sources, which are proliferated with a lot of Republican feelings in from Fox News on the right, and then you have CNN on the left, sir?
It is true that increasingly you see news sources are more opinionated, and you see a blending of opinion and news. This actually doesn't bother me that much. People misunderstand what an opinion is. An opinion is not a feeling. An opinion is a fact stated from your own perspective. They don't teach this very well in school anymore. They don't teach a lot of things very well in school anymore. People confuse opinions with feelings and with preferences. So, but in a, you know, if I say the sky is blue, that's a fact. If I say I think the sky is blue, that's an opinion that is true. That's a true opinion. If I say I like chocolate ice cream more than vanilla ice cream, that's a preference. That's subjective. And people are really confusing those things. So I love, when I go to left-wing websites all the time, because I'm a masochist or something. I don't know. I read a lot of left-wing op-eds. I want to get their opinion. I actually appreciate getting their honest perspective. One, because it tells me what their actual views are, and they're not going to try to hide it in an allegedly objective news article. But also, it's like having a conversation with a leftist. I can see, I wasn't thinking about that side of the story. Oh, what they're saying is wrong, but I see why they think it, and now I need to answer that. I really appreciate that. So I would always recommend to people, I think you're going to have an easier time finding a unicorn than you're going to have a time finding an unbiased news source in 2019, especially on the internet. So what you should do is listen to the right, read the right, read people who you agree with and whose perspectives you really value and respect, and then go read the left and go listen to the left. And you won't respect their opinions, and it's probably going to be mostly incoherent. It's going to sound like those people who were protesting in here. But it will sharpen your points of view. I think the reason conservatives are so much better at politics these days, the reason that conservatives understand so much more what the left is thinking is because we're in a leftist culture. So we just get it all the time. We know what they think. Alyssa Milano has no reason to know what I think. She doesn't ask my opinion. She doesn't come by very often. I don't know what she thinks, generally speaking. So you should take advantage of that. It will make you sharper. It will make you better. It will make you understand the left more. And it'll make you much, much more powerful in as a means of resisting leftism. Yep.
I had a few questions about your job at the Daily Wire and what sort of preparations and studying you have to do to put on the shows. Mm. Oh, and also, do you have an internship program at the Daily Wire?
You know, I think we do. They were going to cancel it after it led to me having a career. You know, Ben said, that's it, no more internship program. But I believe we do. I believe you can apply at the Daily Wire website. But email me directly and I can try to find that. So you were asking about my preparation.
Yeah,
it's a lot like the preparation that I had for my book. I kind of hung around for like 28 or 29 years, and then I got a bestseller. I mean, that's basically what it comes down to. The main preparation I do for the show every day is I read everything on the internet. I consume all of that news, often lying in bed. I'd smoke a cigar if I weren't so lazy I didn't want to roll over and do it. And I just take all of that in. And especially left-wing sources. I do a segment on the show called The Dumbest Article on the Internet Today. It's my favorite segment on the show because so much of it is illogical, but so much of it tells you what the left thinks. So I do a lot of that. And then obviously there's a lot of traveling. One thing I always like to do, I love these speeches, is I always try to write a new speech. And sometimes because of time, that's just not possible. But I find it's more interesting for me. I get to learn something, and I hopefully can convey some fact that someone didn't know before. This is something I love about the Daily Wire, and I would recommend it to everybody in your own jobs and in your own studies. If you can have a job where you really are learning something all the time, and you can do that in virtually any profession if you do it the right way, you should do that. I mean, then you're taking a lot more value out of it than your paycheck. Yep. But also take home a big paycheck. It's very nice. It's good. When that does happen, it works. That's good.
Hi, thank you for coming. How important is the Catholic value of subsidiarity to revitalizing our republic?
To revitalizing our republic? I thought you were going to come up and ask me about just full-on integralism, you know, and overturning the whole government. I'll answer this a little more broadly for people who are not as aware of sort of the long history of Catholic history, which is Catholics have always been sort of outsiders in America. Arthur Schlesinger said that anti-Catholic bias is the most enduring bias in American history. And I'm sure these days he would be pulled apart by leftists for making such a statement. There was one colony for Catholics, Maryland, didn't stay Catholic very long. And so Catholics have always had an interesting perspective here. Even, for instance, when Catholics clamor, as I do, for Bible education in schools, for a long time, that Bible education in schools was used as a way to keep Catholic perspectives out of it. So I think we need to keep a good perspective on all of that. As pertains to the Pope, as pertains to respect for the, obviously we respect the Pope, but as pertains to really listening to him above all else, we have to remember this is totally misunderstood by non-Catholics and even by a lot of Catholics. They think the Pope is infallible. The Pope has invoked infallibility. Any Pope has invoked infallibility twice. Twice. Everything else could be very, very fallible. Very often these days, it is very fallible. That's pretty important to keep in mind. So that's what I'll say on that. I don't want to trash the Pope anymore, so I that's all I'll say on that subject. But obviously, we follow our consciences as Catholics. We have great respect for tradition. We have, obviously, the greatest moment of the week is beholding the Eucharist and receiving the Eucharist if you're a Catholic. And regular access to the sacraments is extraordinarily important. This is true, generally speaking, for people who have any sort of religious views. And obviously, that's central to the Catholic faith. And if we can live that faith, I don't think we're going to find too much conflict in the United States. Yeah. I want to, do we have any more questions? Is that one more, okay, here we go. Were you one of those protesters? No, you don't look like those protesters.
My question is, as a fellow Westchesterian native, are the New York electoral map is fairly Republican towards the north, and then very, very Democrat in the city, and then like the couple counties outside of it. In situations like New York, how do we convince conservatives that their vote matters and it's worth voting and getting out there when it seems like everyone disagrees with us?
I know. How do you convince somebody of a fantasy in so many parts of New York is the real question. It's very difficult. I mean, New York is split, basically, but it's because the city is 13 miles long, it just plays such an outsized role. There's so many millions and millions of people there. Also, New York politics is very corrupt. That's the other problem. It's one of the most corrupt political capitals in the whole country. And so you're going to have a much harder time, and especially in the city or in liberal areas there, you're going to have a real hard time speaking up. A lot of counties, it's not going to matter what their vote is. It's not going to change the election, but it will matter that they voted. And I think this is a broader point, not just on New York politics, but on the culture itself. We joke about those shrieking imbeciles that were just in the room protesting George Washington. They present real threats to your education because the culture is on their side. When I was at University of Missouri, Kansas City, that wacko came up and attacked me with the Super Soaker. And the next day, the chancellor apologized, not to the students in the room who didn't get to hear the talk, not to me who had to go out and buy a new suit. He apologized to the student body generally that they had invited a conservative in the first place. That is, I mean, as crazy as those guys sound, at schools across the country, the administration is on their side. It takes a tremendous amount of courage in that kind of culture. You're risking your grades, you're risking invitations to parties, you're risking your social lives and your personal relationships to go out there and speak the truth as you see it. You should do that. There is nothing to lose except all this stuff. That's all. But what you will have, I know a lot of conservatives who keep their mouths shut, whether it's at the voting booth or whether it's in the culture, and they don't like it. They don't feel good about themselves. They feel that they're being weasels, and they are being weasels. But if you go out there, and even if you lose everything, all your friends, all your grades, all your jobs, you will put your head on your pillow at night, and you will have a grin from ear to ear. And obviously, everybody in this room is doing that, and I applaud all of you, and I am so glad that we can speak the truth, even in the face of shrieking, heckling, yelly, angry leftists. Thank you so very much for coming out.
Thank you. Thank you very much. All right. Thank you, guys. Thanks. All right. Thank you very much. All right. Have a good night. Thank you.